You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest is Emma Copley Eisenberg, and her new book is called The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia. It's an absorbing and beautifully written piece of literature, and I'm anxious to discuss it with her. Emma Copley Eisenberg, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
So this book, it's not like a true crime book, really, stylistically. Before we get to the subject of your book, what sort of writers inspired you to write like this?
I think on the Fresh Air review, they were like, it's a hard to characterize book. And I take that as a compliment, because I think I was trying to pull from strands of a lot of different traditions. For sure, you know, like, this book wouldn't be possible without something like In Cold Blood or Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, but it also wouldn't be possible without books like the essay collection Dead Girls by Alice Bolin, or Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe, which kind of investigate more the ways that we can try to resist these sort of tropes that come along with true crime and the way that gender gets intertwined in these stories. And then I think, like, deep reporting about police really inspired me too. Books like Methland by Nick Redding, and Beyond the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. And then also just kind of strange and wonderful genre-crossing books like The Red Parts by Maggie Nelson and Leslie Jameson's essays. And so lots of different influences.
And yeah, Maureen Corrigan on Fresh Air was over the moon about your book, and I don't blame her, because it's a really great and involving, absorbing, as I was saying, book. I purposely didn't say a lot about your work in the introduction, because The Third Rainbow Girl has some mysteries to it, and I don't want to give too much away. So why don't I let you tell us what you want to tell us about the book?
Sure, yeah. It's kind of funny, because I think that there kind of is no such thing as spoilers with this book, because, yeah, if you pick it up and kind of turn to the first chapter, it's all kind of laid out there on the first page, the kind of major facts and events that happened with this crime. That's kind of the through line of the book. So essentially, the book follows these murders that happened in 1980 in southeast West Virginia, and the ways that those crimes kind of expanded to include many more people than were originally involved, and really became this, like, traumatic event for a whole community. But the crime serves as, in many ways, the spine of the book, but I also really try to bring in kind of two other strands. One is about the community itself, this county called Pocahontas County in southeast West Virginia, and the way that you kind of have to understand the county and its history in the broader landscape of Appalachia and Appalachia's relationship to the broader U.S. in order to understand these events. And then there's also a strand about my own experiences coming to Pocahontas County, the place where these crimes occurred many years later, and the ways that my work there as a AmeriCorps National Service worker started to kind of intersect and resonate with the themes that were coming up from the historical events. So it's a lot of information up front, and my hope is that it's not a stereotypical true crime book, in the sense the sort of point or revelation of the book isn't, like, who did it or what happened, but more so it's really, you know, why and how and what can we take from it is my hope.
And you're not an investigative journalist, you know, by trade, or you're not a detective, or how were you drawn into this story?
Yeah, for sure. I am not an investigative journalist by training. I am a fiction writer by training, but to be fair, I had worked, you know, in my early 20s in various newsrooms as a fact checker and, you know, a writer. So I'd learned sort of the basics of nonfiction reporting in that context, but I came to this story just as a person, just by living there. I think a couple of otherwise lovely reviews have been like, oh, this like intrepid reporter who moved to Pocahontas County to investigate this story. And it's really not so. It was more just that I was living in this place, again, just as a person and as a worker at a cool local nonprofit. And I heard about these crimes that happened in the 80s, actually while I was at a writer's group, just hanging out with people who lived in the area. But it was clear, you know, from the first moment that I heard about them that there was still a lot of unresolved feeling and trauma around these crimes. And so I think often it takes us many years to return to things that have felt significant or will turn out to be big moments in our lives. So about, 4 or 5 years went by before I really sat down to investigate, you know, to understand more what had happened in these crimes. But yeah, I think it was really more of a sense of I've become really close to this place, so kind of fallen in love with this community. And then these crimes or these events that feel really at odds with the community that I knew sort of keep knocking and coming back and wanting to be heard. And so I started looking into just what was available on the internet about the murders, and there was really so little, and what was available was clearly just so wrong. Like, it told a very flat story about this place that I knew by living there was much more complicated. And so there was something in the media coverage from the outside of these cases that immediately was like, this smells like a lie. And I think that's kind of what drew me into hopefully trying to do a better job of telling the truth.
That is, there's a kind of a snobbery about the people of Appalachia, and people don't, you know, we don't take those people seriously, or we think of them in some hillbilly cartoonish way.
Mm-hmm. For sure, yeah. The way that the county and the people that were involved in these crimes were portrayed was like just with such disgust and disdain. And that's something that I try to talk about in the book, as that there, you know, those ideas of what people in the Appalachian Mountains are like come from media and popular culture, but they also really come from capitalism and the pragmatism of what's necessary to do to a community and a people in order to take their natural resources, which is what, you know, broader America has been doing to Appalachia for centuries. So really looking at the ways that the history of the region intersects with stereotypes about the people, and then how that actually played out in this case was something I tried to do also.
One of the threads that you mentioned that runs through your book is the idea that murders of attractive women get a lot of attention and murders of other people don't.
Yes, it's true. I try to build on the work that others have been doing lately around this topic to talk about, right, like, why do we care if a woman, why is it sort of women we care about more about when they're murdered? Because, you know, the vast majority of murders committed in the U.S. are murders of men, mostly men of color. So why is it that we care more about when women are murdered, and why, when women are murdered, do we care more about them if they are pretty, white, middle class? And I try to, you know, essentially ask that question yet again, and it seems that there's just such vastly different outcomes in terms of media attention for these kinds of high-profile missing white woman syndrome. It's sort of been dubbed crimes versus the murders of women who, you know, aren't particularly quote-unquote attractive, which was the case in my book, and then also, as I've tried to write about elsewhere, when women of color or trans women go missing, the media attention is slim to none.
So what, you mentioned that you went to this community of Pocahontas County, and you were working there. How did you happen to go there? I mean, where are you from originally?
Yeah, I am from New York City originally, so very different. I essentially went to a nice liberal arts college outside of Philadelphia, and my college had a relationship with this cool small nonprofit in Southeast West Virginia. And so I had gone there as a college intern during undergrad, and then when I graduated, I was graduating right like at the height of the recession in 2009, and this nonprofit and this place had kind of already seeped into my heart and my consciousness, and I was, you know, excited to go back and learn more, and they offered me a job, but it was through, sort of under the auspices of AmeriCorps, specifically AmeriCorps VISTA, which is a poverty alleviation program in America that's, you know, sort of a holdover from the war on poverty. So I went basically because they offered me a job, but then it was rolled into also a position with AmeriCorps.
And you got there, and did you find the people friendly, welcoming?
Yeah, I did. I think that part of what I am interested, or what, part of what sort of got my attention in the story that had been told about these 1980 murders was the idea that, like, the community was, quote-unquote, like, clannish, or it was protecting, like, some local guy against, you know, the consequences of having murdered these women from elsewhere. And that also just felt so wrong to me because I was a woman from elsewhere, and I didn't at all feel, if anything, it was more like, please come in and be a part of our community, and we will care for you, and you are sort of in the fabric of our community now. And the facts of the case also sort of bear out that, in fact, the local investigators and law enforcement worked tirelessly, you know, if not overzealously, to find the killers of these women. And there was this presumption from the beginning that the killers had been local, or killer or killers had been local people to the crimes, because the women were found in this very isolated location that people assumed, you know, would only be accessible to a local person. But, I mean, yes, this is essentially the only spoiler in the book is, yes, there is an additional theory of the crime that is someone from elsewhere may have actually done these crimes, and I think it's just really interesting that in many ways, what people were saying about the county is, you know, it doesn't want to bring these people to justice, and it wants to, you know, foist it off on someone from elsewhere. But what actually happened was the community was so invested in saying, like, we are bad, you know, someone in our community has done these crimes, that it may actually have overlooked another theory.
So was this a prejudice that it had to be local? Was that coming from the authorities or from the community, or who had this idea?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think really both. It's reflected in the law enforcement notes from the very first, you know, investigation in the first days after these women's bodies were discovered, that there was an assumption that it was someone local, but it also was like a very strong thread and current in the popular understanding, you know, among the community members, too, is my understanding from those I spoke with. And it's interesting. I think this idea of the ways that Appalachia is viewed by outsiders and mainstream America, that I don't think it's possible to grow up and live in a place that the broader society views as so shameful and flawed without kind of internalizing some of those messages oneself. So I think there may actually have been a feeling of, like, we are bad, and this particular kind of sort of random violent masculinity that is often attributed to, like, country guys, like, that must be present here, and it must be our fault in some way. And there was also partly a story that had been told before these women were killed that, you know, essentially people were coming in from all over the nation to attend what was called the Rainbow Gathering, which is a group of sort of nature-loving folks who gather in a public land each summer. And so there were all these people coming from all over the nation in 1980, and many newspaper articles were written about, like, you know, oh, like, these local people don't want these hippies coming in. It was sort of the story that was created before their deaths were, like, a hippies versus Hicks kind of culture clash, if you will. And so then when the women died, people were often very quick to assume, like, oh, it must have been these, like, Hicks who didn't like outsiders, when I think in reality it was much more complicated than that.
Did the crime have a lasting divide in the community?
There are those that I spoke to that I can reflect their opinions, and I'm sure that there are many others who would have other thoughts, and I don't claim to speak for everyone or for the whole community. And my sense is that there will always be disagreement in Pocahontas County about who did these crimes. The man who was eventually brought to trial, Jacob Beard, is a local farmer, and he did serve 6 years for these crimes, and then he was tried again and found not guilty. But there were also 7 additional local men who were accused or incarcerated for periods of time between like 2 months and 2 years, just because they were accused, you know, by another community member. And so I think while the question of like who did it is divisive, I think also the question of like how much pain and suffering was wrought on all these community members just because these two women happened to die in this place is also like an extremely divisive question, because I think some people may be like, well, these people definitely did it and we needed to bring someone to justice, and others are like, but look at all of the damage that was caused to many people's lives, and that sort of still continues to play out without, you know, a lot of conclusion.
Right, not having a definitive conclusion to a crime is disruptive to society at large. Yeah.
For sure.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is Emma Copley Eisenberg, and she's the author of The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia. And it is a very well-written investigation of the murder of two young women in Appalachia back in 1980. They were on their way to a sort of a festival called the Rainbow Gathering when they were found dead. And in addition to being a detailed investigation of this murder, it's different from other true crime books in that it's also a memoir of Emma Copley Eisenberg's own experiences in this same community 40 years later, when she went there to work and live, and how she got involved with the people who lived there and Appalachian music, and discovered that this crime casts a shadow over modern day Appalachia. Now, when I was reading the book, which I loved, by the way, but as I'm reading it, suddenly there's a whole other story, the story of you and the people you met, and there's long periods of time that in the book that aren't about the crime at all.
Sure.
And did you have reservations? Was that always the plan as you were writing the book? Because you reveal a lot about yourself and your private life and things that, and people you knew. Was that difficult?
Yeah, it was never part of the original plan. I think when you're writing a long, heavily researched book, reported book like this, it changes a lot in many different permutations. At first, I thought I was going to write fiction about these events, but I quickly realized that because I'm not from this place and it's not my experience, like, depending on the details that my imagination could supply was never going to be worth anything, or was never going to speak to like the what was really interesting about these events. So, and then I thought maybe I was writing a short essay or a short magazine article, and then after about 2 or 3 years I realized I was writing a book. And at first I thought, yeah, I was just writing a book about the Rainbow Murders, but I think there was always something that felt missing from that. Like, while I did watch way too much Law and Order as a child, I am not actually someone that is a huge true crime, quote-unquote true crime fan. Like, that's not truly, like, a field or genre that I feel at home in, so I knew that I was never really interested in writing a book that was just about these murders and who had done it, and I was more interested in the place and the history of the place and the community. And so I always knew I wanted to find a way to look outward at this community in a contemporary, from a contemporary standpoint. Like, I didn't want the reader to come off after reading this book being like, ah, yes, like, Pocahontas County, West Virginia, a place that existed long, long ago. You know, I wanted people to understand that this is a contemporary place where real people are living their lives and doing interesting work, and that queer people live there, and trans people live there, and people of color live there, and people doing all kinds of innovative work to help, you know, young people stay in the region and thrive instead of leaving, live there. And I also wanted, I felt like if I was going to cast a sort of difficult, intimate lens on other people, I should also do that to myself. And the kind of nonfiction that I admire tends to be nonfiction that doesn't pretend to be, like, neutral or, like, God, but more so nonfiction that acknowledges who the writer is and their own experiences with the subject matter, their own biases, blind spots, all of that. So I think I wanted to be just very transparent with the reader that this is not a book by someone who's even from West Virginia. Like, this is the way that I come to this story. You know, take that for what it is as well.
Did you use real names when you're talking about your contemporary time there?
No. The people in the historical sections largely have real names, and the people in the contemporary sections have pseudonyms to protect people's privacy as much as possible.
And have the people involved read the book, and have they reacted to the book?
Yes. I shared all of the contemporary sections with people, with the people that are in those sections or mentioned in them, and I don't know that everyone has read the full book since it's come out. I think some people have and some people haven't. And yeah, the response has been extremely mixed in the truest sense of the word. Yeah, some people are very hurt and upset, and some people are very excited and feel very seen by the book. So I would encourage, you know, yeah, I've sort of been saying, like, a lot of the people that I knew there are writers and creators and policymakers and people that have, you know, their own access to speaking about the book, and I welcome anything that they want to write about it or talk about it. Like, I'm sure those conversations will be long and ongoing.
How does it feel to you? I mean, if people were hurt, is that, what's that like?
I mean, it's always awful to feel that there, you know, you've added to the net pain of the world rather than taken it away or kept it neutral. Like, that's never a good feeling. And that is certainly not, I think, like, the feeling I have in my heart towards this community and the people that are in the book is all love. And I hope that comes through. But I also think that everyone's entitled to their own reaction, especially when it concerns something as intimate as these crimes and also the community that's a small community. I can certainly understand all reactions to it.
Well, I mean, even the cover of your book is sort of a dark place that has light shining on it. And I guess that's one of the things that you're doing with this book, is you're shining a light on both the good and bad things that are happening there.
Yeah, I hope so. I feel like love doesn't always look like just unequivocal praise of something. I'm not sure that that's the only thing that love can look like. So yeah, my hope is that, you know, right, treating a place or a person with dignity also means acknowledging, you know, and asking for accountability and acknowledging the ways that both I and other people may have maybe flawed. So, yeah, we talked a lot about the cover, and the original cover was much more, like, sad Appalachian mountains with, like, barbed wire, and I was like, no, like, I asked very clearly for a cover that had some light to it or some beauty, because my feeling about the place is not at all that it's a dark place.
It's a very beautiful cover photograph. I love it. And I think it's really hard to not read the book when you see it. I guess that's the point of it, right?
That's a good sign. Thanks.
Yeah. So you said you were from New York, and New York has got a certain, you know, musical sound. And then you went to Appalachia, and Appalachia has a very different musical sound. And had you heard a lot of bluegrass or that kind of music before? And how did it kind of grab you?
Yeah. I mean, my parents are old hippies, so I had heard, like, you know, a lot of sort of folk and bluegrass light in the places that folk encountered bluegrass and sort of popularized it, and like Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and those kinds of things. But I had never really heard like traditional bluegrass, like Flat and Scruggs or any of those folks, until I went to Pocahontas County and was living there. And yeah, I think something that surprised me was just how much talent and pride there is in those musical traditions, particularly in Pocahontas County, which is home to a really amazing old-time and bluegrass music school called Allegheny Echoes that happens every year in Pocahontas County. And so just like the amount of really talented musicians that live in the area is just astonishing. So I got to, you know, profit from that in the sense that I just got to listen to it and be a part of it. And I got a few pointers on playing the banjo, which was really fun. So, yeah, one of the things that I think maybe is important to know about writing this book, or any book maybe, is that there's just so much stuff that gets cut out and left behind. And, right, I had a much longer sort of tangent about the music traditions of Pocahontas County that I wrote and that didn't make it into the book, probably for good reason. But I hope that someone else, maybe someone from West Virginia or nearby, you know, writes a really amazing book that many people can read about that area and its musicians, because it's really astounding.
Well, I'm interested, and I want to read what you wrote. But so you play the banjo?
Very poorly.
And so now you live in Philadelphia, but has this bluegrass thing stuck with you? Do you still play? Are you still listening to that kind of music?
It did for a while. I was very involved in the sort of amateur bluegrass old time scene in Philadelphia, but what I quickly kind of discovered, though, is that I think a lot of people like my age, you know, sort of 20s, 30s, like as this kind of like Americana branded music, like Gillian Welch and Shovels and Rope and all that stuff has kind of come up. Like, I don't think that many people know much about the difference between that and bluegrass, and I don't think that many people know the difference between old time music and bluegrass. So most of the kind of traditional American music that I could have access to in Philadelphia or the Northeast was more like old time, which is also beautiful, but a totally different tradition than bluegrass. Much older, actually, than bluegrass, right? But I would sort of try to seek that out for a while, and I did make a very bad short documentary about bluegrass musicians in Philly. But I think I mostly just listened to like the four CDs that people in Pocahontas County gave me, kind of over and over again, and by myself.
This book is doing very well now, and you worked on it for a long time. How long did you actually work on writing this book?
It was about 7 years from starting the book to it coming out, but I would say I was also working on other things during that time. Probably like more like 4 years of really writing it.
But now that it's out there and you can't write it anymore, what is that? Do you feel a separation from the Third Rainbow Girl?
Yeah, I think something that I wish we talked about more is just that when you are blessed to go through this long and twisty process of publishing a book, it takes a very long time, and also it is often like the sort of person that you are when you're talking about the book, like now, and me in 2020 is kind of like three selves later than the self that wrote the book, and about like six selves later than the person who's, you know, a character, me, in the book. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot of time and a lot of changing of perspective that happens, I think, in the process of releasing a book, which is natural and cool in some ways. But yeah, I do kind of feel like a different person wrote the book at this point, because yeah, it's really been about 2 years since I was actively engaged in writing the book. So yeah, there's been a lot of time for me to change my mind and question things and wish I could have put stuff in, but I also appreciate it and stand behind it as a work that, you know, belongs to me, even if it's a past me.
So your next book will be The Fourth Rainbow Girl, is that right?
Definitely not. I hope I am feeling very in awe of those who write difficult research nonfiction book after difficult research nonfiction book, but I feel very tired, and I am hopeful actually to be working on fiction. So I think my next book will probably be fiction, probably a novel. We shall see.
But this is your first published full-length book, right?
It is, yes.
And so now a novel. Well, it kind of feels, it has a novelist feel, the Third Rainbow Girl, for sure.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I definitely am more trained in like fiction technique in some ways than I am in nonfiction, although I think they're, you know, as long as you have some basic skills, fiction techniques really serve, you know, writing nonfiction, I think. So, yeah, it was a fun process.
Well, it's an interesting time that we're living in to have just published a book. I mean, how has the coronavirus affected the publicity and all the things you're doing right now?
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate to get about like 6 weeks of like living in the regular arts and culture publicity scene, which can be tricky and fickle as it is. But I did get to go to like about 12 cities and see lots of amazing people who had been very supportive of the book, and get some nice reviews when the world was a little bit quieter. So I feel very fortunate. I feel worse for friends of mine who have put so many years into writing books, and they're coming out like this week or last week to a very changed landscape. So yeah, it's strange, and I certainly had a lot of things canceled and lost income. And I hope that, you know, in this time, obviously, like, the most important things are health and safety of folks, but just urging people to also think about the livelihoods of bookstores, independent bookstores, and, you know, artists in their communities. And I know there's some fundraising efforts in Philadelphia where I live for writers and bookstore workers who have lost income and projects and all of that, but I'm sure we'll continue to see the effects for many months, unfortunately.
And since people will be at home, it'd be a great time to do some reading. And
yeah,
I highly recommend The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia, and the author, Emma Copley Eisenberg, who's spent some time with us today. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. And people can also listen to the audiobook, which I got to narrate myself, which was a lot of fun.
So you actually did the reading of the audiobook?
I did in this case, yeah. You don't always get to, but I talked my way into it this time.
So what was that like? I mean, it's one thing to write the book and then put it out there and have people read it, but you're actually reading it out loud. What's the actual process like of recording an audiobook?
Yeah, it was really fun. It took about 5 days, 9 to 5. I got very familiar with throat coat, the tea, and cough drops, and how many noises your body makes normally when you're just sitting around and you don't notice it. But it was actually kind of beautiful because it was really the first time I'd read the book beginning to end. Yeah, in, you know, probably about a year and a half, and so it was really good to kind of revisit it and sit with it as it was about to come out. And yeah, at times it was quite emotional because I was reading in the voices of people, like reading out loud the quotes of these women who were killed, or reading out loud the courtroom testimony of a couple of these guys whose lives were really decimated by this case, I think, wrongly. And so yeah, some of that was emotional, and I didn't really do any like accents or sort of like slang, but I tried to you know, give people a little bit of rhythm differences or a little bit of a sense of how they might have sounded, like, in terms of their cadence and that stuff. But I'm not a voice actor, but it was really fun to try.
And was it done in a recording studio?
It was, yeah. Hachette, my publisher, which, you know, they also have, Hachette Audio also includes, like, Little Brown and a lot of other imprints, so they have a little recording studio in Manhattan that I went to, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Because they usually have an actor or somebody who, they usually have an actor doing it.
Yeah, I think for fiction, it's almost always an actor. For nonfiction, especially, like, memoirs and essay collections and stuff, I think they often will give the author a shot at it. So in this case, I got to audition, essentially, to play myself. And I was not so terrible that they said no.
You don't make a very good Emma Copley Eisenberg. No, it turns out you do. You're the best Emma Copley Eisenberg they could possibly get.
I know. Yeah, it was very funny, but... Yeah, I mean, I respect voice acting. It's very difficult, and I know that there are some really great voice actors out there, but I also listen to a lot of audiobooks that feel, like, so overacted that it's, like, difficult to listen. So I try to emulate the ones that I like.
Unfortunately for me, I'm usually in so much of a hurry, not that I want to race through the book, but I need to read it because I'm going to be talking to the author, and then I'm going to talk to another author next week. So I don't usually have time for the audiobook, but...
Oh, fair enough.
Maybe now I'll have to go back and listen to you.
I know. Some people say they listen to audiobooks on, like, 2x or 3x speed, but...
that would be distracting.
Yeah.
That would be like Alvin and the Chipmunks reading you.
Yeah, it sounds a little bonkers, I think, when you do that.
Well, Emma Copley Eisenberg, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf. And the book, one more time, is The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Emma Copley Eisenberg. She's the author of The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia. And as she was just saying, she also is the narrator of the audiobook version. If that's your preference, it's a great book. I think you'd like it a lot. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Also on my bookshelf this week is a Blu-ray of a brand new film from director Julian Shaw. The film is very good, and it's called Use Me. Use Me is a thriller that masquerades as a documentary. The actress who stars in the film is Ciara Lynch. In the movie, she portrays an online dominatrix named Ciara Lynch. She's great in the film and a bit of a mysterious figure. Her Internet Movie Database biography says she's 5'7" and nothing else. If you've seen Use Me, you're probably curious, and if you haven't seen Use Me, you should see it. In any case, we should find out a bit more about her tonight because she's my guest. Ciara Lynch, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
And we don't want to give away too much about the substance of Use Me because there's a lot of fun surprises in the film, but tell us a little bit about the film. What is Use Me?
Use Me is a project I've been working on. Started about 7 years ago. I got in touch with the writer-director Julian Shaw. And it started out, the idea was to do a pure documentary about me, but somewhere along the way, I think Julian realized that I'm just not a very interesting subject for a documentary because my life is pretty happy, pretty content, and it's just not really interesting for a movie. So from there, we decided to do something a little different and make what we like to call a hybrid documentary. So it feels like a documentary when you're watching it, but there is a fictional storyline woven within it. And we tried to really blend the two together so that it's not real obvious to tell which parts are real and which parts aren't. And, yeah, it just came out in November, and the feedback so far has been really great, so pretty proud of it.
No, it's been getting a lot of attention and praise, and it's a great movie. I really enjoyed it myself. But... did you feel uncomfortable or bad when it turned into something else?
No, why would I?
Well, because you wanted it to be a documentary about you, but your life is probably not that boring, Ciara Lynch.
No, it really is. I just hang out and I read books and, I am not a good subject for a documentary. And it's not like it started out that I wanted to do a documentary and then he changed it. It was a process we went through together. We worked, you know, cyber. I mean, he did it, the most of the work. He did all the writing and directing, so I'm not going to say that, you know, I did as much work as he did, but I was involved every step of the way and every decision that was made. So I'm quite happy with the final product.
Well, so how much of the character that you play is actual documentary? So is it like, is it your house that we see you in?
Yep, that's my house.
And,
I'm not going to tell you which parts are real, which parts aren't. You'll have to figure that out for yourself.
Okay. So, well, there are actors in the film, though.
Yes. Yes, there's an actor, Joe Reitman, and Jasmine Yoder are the two main actors that we hired for the movie.
And how did you cast them? Did you have auditions?
We had a few auditions for Jasmine, who played Princess Cassie. So, you know, we just sat down and looked at a bunch of audition tapes. Joe is a different story. He's actually, he was one of Julian's first friends that he made when he first started just coming to the U.S. And Julian thought he would do an amazing job playing just a creepy guy. And then later he finds out that Joe is kind of typecast to play creepy guys. It definitely wasn't his first rodeo. So, yeah, he did the job really well.
So, the character that you play is really you, and you really do this online service that you perform, or do you consider yourself in the adult film industry or an adult entertainer or what?
Yeah, sure. All that. I think the best word to describe me is a humiliatrix. Most people don't know what that means, and so yeah, you can call me a porn star, that's fine. I don't really have sex on camera, so I don't know how really accurate that is. You can call me a sex worker, you can call me an adult film performer, fetish model, it's all good.
And how long have you been doing that?
16 years.
Oh, well, that seems like a long time.
It is a long time.
Yeah, I mean, most people in the adult industry are in it for a very short period of time.
Most women who go into mainstream porn have a pretty short shelf life. Yeah, that's right. But there's a lot more longevity if you are an independent producer like myself and you do more niche fetish type work. There's, you can, there's a lot of room to have a career there.
How do you feel about the adult industry in general? I mean, do you think it's been criticized for being exploitive and things like that?
Sure. I mean, if there's opportunities to exploit people, then predators will take advantage of that. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, I think with the internet, it's completely changed the game. Women don't need to have a middleman to get into the adult industry. They don't need some, like, creep behind a camera that's going to undercharge them or take advantage of them. They can just buy a webcam and make their own money. So I think things have really changed, and all for the better.
Well, the film is called Use Me, and people can get it on Blu-ray from Amazon, I think, and anywhere else that sells
yep.
Blu-ray. And is
yep,
that
that's correct.
Did it have a theatrical release too?
We already did the festival circuit, so we premiered at the Brooklyn Film Festival. We did the Sydney Underground Film Festival, the Portland Film Festival. So, you know, now that it's out on Amazon, no one's going to have us in a theater.
But so what was that like when it played? And did you go to the premiere and you went to the festivals and so forth?
I did. Yeah, I've been to every festival, and it's awesome. It's so nice to finally have the movie out there and see how people react to it. You know, it's kind of crazy to work on something for so long. And once it's done, like, it's kind of out of your hands a little bit, like how people will react to it. But I'm pretty thankful that it's been mostly positive response, so it's really cool.
You've sat in the theater and watched people watch it.
Yes.
And what was that like?
It was amazing. It's cool to see people's reactions and what parts they laugh at, what parts they cringe at. It's awesome to see how they respond to the, you know, the ending, because there's like a few twist endings, and yeah, it's great. It's a good feeling.
All right. Well, the film is called Use Me, and everybody should go see it. And my guest, Ciara Lynch. Ciara, thanks for spending a few minutes with us on From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, no problem.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.